This is Floss Weekly. I'm Doc Searles. This week, Sean Powers and I talked to Maxie Reynolds about subsea cloud. This is a hugely weird and important topic. This is putting servers underwater in the ocean and making a business out of it. And this seems to have a really big future, shorter latencies, all kinds of features you wouldn't think were possible and kind of unusual, but boy, is it interesting, and that is coming up next.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Floss Weekly, episode 691, recorded Wednesday, July 27th, 2022. Subsea Cloud. This episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by IRL, an original podcast from Mozilla. IRL is a show for people who build AI and people who develop tech policies. Hosted by Bridget Todd, this season of IRL looks at AI in real life. Search for IRL in your podcast player. And by Bitwarden, get the password manager that offers a robust and cost-effective solution that can drastically increase your chances of staying safe online. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or Enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. Hello again, everybody, everywhere. I am Doc Searles. This is Floss Weekly. And not only everybody everywhere in the world, but under the ocean as well. It's the topic today. I am joined by Sean Powers himself, who appears to be on land, where he was when I saw him in a rectangle a few minutes ago. There he is.
I was
going
to say, if everybody's hoping I'm going to be like underwater, I can't pull that filter up quick enough. But
we're talking subsea today. And I even blew the intro I was going to do on that, but that's how it goes. So you familiar with this yet, Sean?
We've had I been am, joking. I am. And there's a lot of really cool topics to talk about today. It's going to, I think this is one of those episodes where we're going to wish that it was longer because some episodes are like, oh, what else could we talk about? This isn't going to be one of those, I don't think.
I know. And we got off to a late start because nothing worked. I just arrived back in Bloomington, Indiana, where I am. And after an 800-mile drive from New York City, because the vacation we were going to take in New England, visiting many old friends, celebrating my birthday in Cape Cod, where I got this T-shirt.
But it's a lobster.
A lobster from Cape Cod. Anyway, that isn't happening. So I'm in the basement back in Bloomington, and it was all prepared for all kinds of cool stuff. But this is a great show. And we're going to jump right into it. Our guest today is Maxie Reynolds, who came to us via Dave Tad, who's been another earlier guest who has nothing but interesting people to introduce us to. And her topic is subsea cloud. That's cloud under the water. So
under the sea,
under the sea. So Maxie, welcome to the show.
There she is.
For those of you not visually impaired, there she is. So tell us, not so much about that, but where, how do you get to this? What's your backstory on this? As much of it as you can let us know.
Like, be prepared to.
And where are you? You're above the water right now, I imagine.
No, I'm way under. I'm in Los Angeles. Like, I couldn't be in a drier place. So I live in Los Angeles, but I'm from Scotland. I've been in America for about 15 years or so. My accent has gotten worse. It's gotten stronger. It stays with me. It will not leave.
I can understand you. So that's a good sign.
That's good. That's positive, I would say. But some people still require some subtitles. So it becomes an issue here and there. And I've got a really good Southern accent. So if people can't understand, we can switch to that later. But Basically, I worked offshore oil and gas for about 10 years as a robotics pilot and ROV pilot. So ROVs are like large robots that we put underwater to do work down there. So on pipelines, on wellheads, you know, a lot of like the oil infrastructure so that we can all run our lives, and also some like Nat Geo type things. We do that under the water too. So I'd done that for about 10 years. And then I had been offshore for such a long time that I'd racked up a lot of long distance education, because when you're offshore, you're month on, month off, but you're also 12 hours on, 12 hours off. And so I had like a few degrees just to spite myself. Like I took difficult ones. And one of them was computer science. So I ended up with a job from PwC in Australia, and I got a job on their graduate team. I was really old for a graduate. Like there was all these 20-year-olds running around and like drinking on a Tuesday. And I was like in my 30s at this point. But they taught me ethical hacking, and I got kicked out of Australia, not for hacking, but visa. And I came back to the States, and I went into like a subset of cybersecurity, which is red teaming or social engineering. And that took me a lot of places. And one of the things that you do is, aside from the logical hacking, you also break into places. So you're physically breaking into them. So we were breaking into like some government departments, pharmaceutical headquarters, prisons. So like one of the few people on earth to have broken into a prison, and also data centers. And so I sort of had this intersection, this almost like randomality, where I had this subsea engineering background, and I also had this new insight into data centers and what's in them, why it's important, and also that you can physically break into them. Some of them are really difficult, but it's rarely impossible. And so I come back to subsea engineering and designed these pods to put under the water, where the physical security is absolute. So are you glad Absolute. You asked? That was long.
So, yeah. Wow.
So, yeah. All right. So you had me at, I get to drive robots under the ocean with a joystick. I mean, that's pretty yes. much every, you know, every young person's dream job. I kind of wish I got to do that, but, it's interesting for me though. And this has actually nothing to do with the technology, but I'm curious. So you drove these robots. How much time did you actually spend much time in the water itself, or I mean, no. Is your experience with the ocean pretty dry?
It's fairly dry. So essentially, you sit on a vessel or a rig, an oil rig, and we've got like a 20-foot container. So everybody else gets sort of an in-house place. We get put on top with a container, actually two. So one's like a tooling container, and then the other one, which you will like, is sort of like a big, like, PlayStation Xbox room. So essentially, you go into this container and it's got probably eight screens on the wall most of the time, like eight big TVs, televisions, and you have like these two like gamers chairs essentially, and then some joysticks. And the screens are for the various different tooling that we have on the ROV. So it's got eyes, it's got cameras, it's got arms so you can see what they're doing. It's got sonar so you can sort of see what's around. And we just sit on that vessel and do some work. And sort of go ahead.
No, I was just going to say, well, based on my video gaming skills, I would not be hired, because I mean, I would just crash into the robots and fish would kill me just by swimming past. But it is interesting that was the switch over to like a cybersecurity, was that just happenstance? Is that just something you had interest in, or did the job itself kind of push you in that direction?
It was haphazard. So I left Scotland very early and, you know, started like adult life very early and had like swore to have the most interest in life possible, and that sort of subsided at some point, but I had a good run at it. So but basically working offshore, I just had a lot of time to get these degrees, and one of them was computer science, because I had all of these people around me saying like computers are the future, and I was thinking, aren't computers already here? Wasn't I born with one?
I'm driving a robot. So, I think we're there.
Yeah, I think we've got there, guys. But they were sort of right, and in terms of it's more and more of the future. And so that the haphazard long distance computer science degree was a big help. And you know, I had degrees in, I don't want to say BS, but I had degrees in where I was never going to make much money. So you're not going to make a lot of money off philosophy or make a decent living. And I was used to making a good living. And so that was kind of the push. And then I got to move to Australia. So I was bye, see ya. And I went, it was really enjoyable.
Until you had to leave. Because of visa, not because
until they were like, but, well, and it's not that they, well, and they did arrest me just one time. So you perform OSINT, you do all of these things as a pen tester or a logical hacker. And I was very, very new. And so I thought I knew what I needed to know, but it turns out you can only know what you don't know, sort of thing. You can only know you don't know things. So I was sort of, and we got hired, PwC got hired for the state's water company, and I switched the water off by accident. And instead of just believing, Occam's razor, the simplest is probably true, which is that I was really new, a bit ditzy, and I accidentally had turned it off. They thought I was a Russian spy. And I was like, but I'm Scottish. And they were like, you sound Russian. I was like, you've never been to Scotland. We all sound like this. So I just didn't apply for a second visa in case I had to go into a secondary interview and be
That's
accused of being a spy. I know.
Yeah, and I think it's fair that we should clarify when you said earlier that you break into places and break into jails and buildings. You were hired to do that. I mean, you didn't start a rogue band of Ocean's 11 jewel thieving ring or anything like that. I mean, that's kind of the whole idea behind. Yeah, right. It's probably more profitable. But so the pen testing and red team, which those two terms are often used interchangeable, and I know that there's a separation. Different. I think that the based on the I recently taught a course on pen testing, and a lot of the pen testing stuff, if you want to get certified, is red team stuff. I mean, it's far more about the social engineering maybe than it used to be. You know, pen testing was often just software based stuff. But my take as I was teaching the course, and to be clear, I didn't finish the course because I just didn't enjoy it. Right. I felt like I was teaching people to basically start a crime ring. I mean, I was hoping the people watching were using it for good, but I mean, these, you know, the tactics and what I found, and you've done this far more than me, I mean, and in the real world, it seems to me that human meat sacks tend to be the weakest link in almost every system. And I mean, is that fair? That was my take. As I was teaching, it seemed like while there are weaknesses in software, people are so much easier to manipulate. And in my life, there are people who have been scammed so many times that I think that's just continues to be true.
Yeah, so you've hit a few points there. The first thing is that, and I have an entire book on this that I'll just tell you about. You don't have to read it. Essentially, the end of it says that we're not dumb. There's a saying, it's something it's human stupidity is the biggest vulnerability. It's not that. It's not stupidity. It's simply that we're human. So we have these biases. We have these tendencies. And essentially con men, and that's what you are if you're a social engineer, for the good, but essentially you're still manipulating people for some end goal, which ultimately is the betterment of their security. But at the time, it's just to get past them. And you have to be very mission focused. You can't be thinking about how much this is going to hurt them or, you know, how bad you feel. You just have to push on, and not everybody can do that. And I don't know where I stand on that morally in terms of if you can push past it, what does that mean about you? I would give that no thought because I can push past it. But basically, humans are vulnerable. And so the more that we bring that up as a topic, raise awareness and expose it, I think probably the better off society will be to know that, hey, there are people out there sort of preying on you as the receptionist, as the security guard, whatever it may be. And then pen testing is in and of itself, there are a lot of software vulnerabilities that can go years unnoticed, as we see everywhere.
Yeah. For the record, I just to clarify, it wasn't something I could do. I don't think somebody's ability to, see the forest for the trees and be able to realize that there's a deeper good. That's a good thing. I don't think that's a moral failing. Surgeons cut people open all day long.
Yeah.
If I did that, it would be very evil. But I couldn't either. You know, I literally faint at the sight of blood. So, I mean, I'm not going to be a surgeon anytime. I want to be clear. I personally had a difficulty doing that, but I don't think that somebody who can has a moral failing. I didn't want to imply that, and I apologize if I did.
No, you didn't. You didn't. It's just, it sort of comes up. It's a natural sort of stopping point that we all ponder when we're inside, like, oh, because you do feel bad. You know, one of the worst things that I remember feeling was this overwhelming sense of guilt, because I was talking to this really old, and I mean, like, sort of like this was his part-time job after he'd retired. So I think he's definitely...
He's like in his 40s. You know, the guy's so... No. Oh, no, just kidding.
He was in his 80s. He definitely was. And he talked to me on the way out. I planned to ignore him because I already knew that I was going to like have this internal just dichotomy of, yeah, okay, target him. And then no, like stop. So he missed on my way out. And I was like, mother. So I was like, oh, hello. He said he'd started making polite conversation, and it was so easy to get information from him. And I felt really bad. And I sort of thought to myself, it's like human intel. It's another form of open source, essentially. And I was thinking, God, do I put this in the report? I really don't want to. What if he gets fired? This is really bad. And like, I didn't put everything in the report. I couldn't do it. And that's the wrong way to look at it. That didn't help him get any better, and it didn't help the company. So let's move on. Let's not talk about the company. I don't want to.
Well, I have to, I have some questions about, the whole open source thing, cause we're here for open source. And another quick question, but first, I have to let everybody know that this episode of Floss Weekly is brought to you by IRL, an original podcast from Mozilla. IRL is a show for people who build AI and people who develop tech policies. It's hosted by Bridget Todd. This season of IRL looks at AI in real life. Who can AI help? Who can it harm? The show features fascinating conversations with people who are working to build more trustworthy AI. For example, there's an episode about how our world is mapped with AI. The data that's missing from those maps tells as much a story as the maps themselves. You'll hear all about the people who are working to fill in those gaps and take control of the data. There's another episode about gig workers who depend on apps for their livelihood. It looks at how they're pushing back against algorithms that control how much they get paid and seeking new ways to gain power over data to create better working conditions. For political junkies, there's an episode about the role that AI plays when it comes to the spread of disinformation around elections, a huge concern for democracies around the world. And another episode explains the role that AI plays when it comes to elections and the spread of misinformation and hate speech. All of this, by the way, is very close to my heart and mind, because it seems to me we're constantly trying to fight this stuff while we have to use it, because we need machines to extend our own intelligence while they acquire intelligence of their own. How can we reconcile those? This is all over that stuff, and it's really important. So search for IRL in your podcast player. We'll also include a link in the show notes. My thanks to IRL for their support. So Maxie, the first thing is, I don't know if you answered this already or not, because I was busy dealing with a bunch of technical issues while Sean was taking over. But the platforms you worked on, were those in Southern California? I asked because I live in Santa Barbara normally, and I'm looking out on those platforms from there. Yeah. And it's always been a kind of fantasy of mine to go out there and, like, you know, see how they do what they do. Were you at any those, or were you?
I've never been offshore in California. I have been offshore in the Gulf, but not in California. We can steal it. We can commandeer a boat and go out there if you like.
Oh, please. Okay, let's stay. Yeah. Let's put a bookmark on that.
Let's do that.
This is a sure thing. Let's do it.
I really like the sort of ecosystem of an oil rig. It's interesting and it's busy and it's sort of like masculine, I suppose. Well, I don't suppose it is. But it's just enjoyable. Just things work systematically. There are processes for everything. I kind of feel the same zen in sort of hospitals and airports, although not airports just now. But, you know, it's just process driven. Things work. If they don't work, we fix them. And then you go to sleep. It's great. I like it.
And it has to work. I mean, there are so many points of failure you can't tolerate. I mean, like in an airplane, like, well, we hope this thing goes, you know?
Yeah, we're hoping for the best,
guys.
It's
similar out there. And mentioned to go, I mean, you know, the ones in California are actually in fairly shallow water, but the ones in the Gulf are, like, you know, taller than skyscrapers under the water. And then the North Sea back in your homeland, that's some of the most hostile conditions on Earth. So
the North Sea, very difficult environment to work in. Yeah.
Well, we can put a bookmark, a number of things there. But so tell me about the open source side of this, because, you know, there's a lot there.
So the extent of, like, anything open source that we use is still, like, OSINT. It's still, because I should say, to sort of back up and then reverse into this, I'm an infrastructure provider with these pods. I'm the room or the building that the servers go in. I don't have much to do with what is happening on the servers. So where I use, like, OSINT is actually in terms of trying to find geohazard information on the seabed or about the seabed. So there's a lot of surveys being done where there are already assets, and that's typically where I want to deploy. I don't want to deploy very often, you know, where there is nothing else subsea. I need to be where there's power, and I need to be where there is already submarine cables, which are about 99% of our internet. They are the backbone of the internet. So I use, like, open source intelligence to gather that information. So there's a really interesting site. I think it's something like, you know, submarinecables.com, and it shows you all of the cables around the world where they're connected to. So that's a sort of open source material. And so I think, okay, where can I deploy and where are their power cables? And then I also use it to try to discover where there are going to be or where there are operational wind farms, things like that. So, like, that's the extent of our use, but it's a lot of data. There's a lot out there, especially if you know the search terms or can work well in that environment in terms of, like, pulling up information. And also then not just pulling up the information, but being able to thread the needle as you go, because you'll find information that will lead you to more information, which is actually the real skill in OSINT, in open source intelligence.
And to be clear, so we say OSINT, you know, it's kind of we're saying that, but yeah, open source intelligence. And in the, you know, I mean, we kind of transitioned from breaking into places and systems and stuff into a different aspect of that, because open source intelligence is not just about, like, social engineering people. This is just information that is openly available on any topic anywhere. I mean, intelligence meaning,
correct,
you know, information, and then open. So things like using it to locate your center, that, I mean, that's brilliant, and that's incredibly awesome, because in a not open type environment, that could be information that, you know, a government would keep to itself, and I could easily see a government saying, well, all of this information is national security. I mean, if everybody knows information on the seafloor, then they can, you know, attack us. So it's awesome that that is open, you know, to use and to explore. So, I mean, that's really awesome. I'm a little bit curious and pretty, I'm not going to be able to restrain myself much longer before I ask for lots of details. We talked before the show started because I couldn't shut up and I couldn't not ask questions before the show. Your history with red teaming, penetration testing, open source intelligence on people and stuff obviously gives you a cybersecurity mindset when you approach things. And one of the things that makes an undersea data center so attractive is that even if you steal somebody's key, it's not like you're going to dive down 100 meters to open the door, right? I mean, so there's a certain level of security just in proximity to the bottom of the ocean. That's awesome in that, you know, it's, I mean, security, geographic security. I don't even know what the term for that would be.
I'll take that. I'm going to write that down. But yes,
there you go.
That works.
There you go. I get why it's awesome. Also, the whole idea of cooling and being carbon neutral appeals to me personally. I don't know where that stands. And it's almost in opposition kind of to the oil industry that we've talked about.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, they would like to be carbon neutral in every way, but they're literally digging up carbon and anyway, that's a whole nother topic.
Yes.
I am curious. Can you give us, how many details can you give us about what is actually on the bottom of the ocean that you're managing here? You said that you don't have the server infrastructure. You're basically the data center. How does that work? How do people put things in? Give us all the deets.
Okay. let's start at the end. So I am the infrastructure provider. I simply provide like the walls of it and the racks, but not the servers themselves. I go to Oracle, I go to those sorts of large providers, and they bring their clients. Typically, there are other scenarios, so the military, but again, not my servers, they put their servers in, or a direct client, so you know, name Facebook, they still provide their own servers. I just provide like this engineering feat. And so that's side one. But the physical security is sort of absolute in a few ways. So we do a few things. We bury them subsea. We bury them under the seafloor sometimes for some factions. We might bury them under the sand if it's a sand seabed. There are a lot of different types of sediment in seabed, but if it's sand, we can bury them. But what we always do is we have offshore like big suction cups, you know, the things that you stick, like children's toys that stick to a window sort of thing. They're sort of like that. We take them and they're just big cups, upside down cups, and push them onto the seabed, and it creates like a vacuum, and that keeps things very steady. But what we also have are these guideposts that we essentially lock the pods into, and you really will struggle to get those out, even if you're sort of a hostile nation looking to steal this country's data. You will very much struggle to get them out without the proper tooling. And even if you have the proper tooling, we have mechanisms built in that it would still be almost impossible. And we have sensors, things like that. So, because it's a huge disruption to be pulling a 20-foot pod up. So we would know about it quite quickly. But also we have this sort of built-in mechanism that if you pulled it off of this guidepost, of this like security post, if you want, through this lens, the data, the information would be destroyed. You would destroy it by trying to steal it, sort of thing. So we have those things built in, and we had to. And then on top of that, we try to sit below where submarines can go to. So the best submarines in the world can go to sort of 400 feet in the water before, you know, that before they cannot be there anymore. And we can go down to about 3,000 meters, about 9,000 feet. We don't always sit that low. We just need to sit lower than them. So we do that for physical security too. And again, the cybersecurity is the same. We suffer from the same things that everyone else does. The providers suffer from the same threats. But the physical security is...
Are these pods then loaded up on dry dock and then completely sealed and submerged.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Okay. And these are, I mean, so I manage servers in multiple data centers here in the above yeah. the, you know, on dry ground.
Yeah.
And every once in a while, you know, we have to send a guy out to yeah. do something because something goes wrong. Yeah. Do you just, the customers just have to build in a way such that they know there's absolutely no way they're ever going to touch these servers again?
No.
I mean, is that pretty much
that
how things
great.
Go?
That would be great. That would save a lot of money. But no, what we do is, so you're right. We network them on land. We then close these pods up and then we put the fluid in. So they become sort of immersion cooled. But without any need for pumps. Yeah, yeah. So it's
and
sort of...
And pressure's not an issue then, if it's... Okay.
It's not... Exactly. They're compensated from the inside. And so we push them down. And if they're in a port or in very shallow water, it takes about 30 minutes to get them to their, like, living place, to their point of location and operation. And if they're further offshore, it can take a couple of hours, but we lock them in. Then we have periodic maintenance times or times where, because, you know, most clients will say, okay, we are going to switch these servers out in 18 months. And so we pencil that in and we know that we're going to have to go back out there in 18 months. Now, if there's a failure, we have redundancy. So if it's one server, we're not very concerned. That's pretty normal. If we have a rack, we might fail in place. If it's more than that, then we'll go out with our boat, our vessel, and we'll pull it up, take out the fluid, and then fix it. So it kind of depends. A, it depends on the client, and B, it depends on the problem. But what we have found is that we're about 1/8 the maintenance needs for compared to a traditional data center, because fluid... is way less corrosive than oxygen or most gases. And so we kind of don't face some of the same contaminants, the same corrosion. And then there's no humans in there. And humans are a huge problem in data centers, from walking down the aisles to nudging wires to just performing
in general,
erroneous.
Humans in
yeah,
general.
Just in general. I agree. I agree. But so, you know, our maintenance is sort of pushed down, but at the same time, people are a little bit nervous quite often to have their servers underwater. And one of the ways that we've combated this, and it sort of speaks to the what we talked about earlier with human vulnerability, if you can find a way to appease that, even if it's kind of inconsequential, it doesn't matter to the human brain. The human psyche is like, perfect. So people are like, but we want to see our servers. And we said, well, what if we put cameras in the pods? They were like, great. I was like, okay, like, I'm fine. I'm not going to point out anything, but all right. So yeah.
That's okay. So by strange mm-hmm. happenstance, I actually used to manage several thousand servers that were cooled in liquid, like they were submerged, and it was like a mineral oil kind of thing that they circulated. We actually, again, this is above ground, to be clear, I don't live in one of your pods, but we still had to circulate that mineral oil through the system and pipe it out to a cooling tower because, you know, I mean, it's great at dissipating the heat, but it's still, you know, there's still heat. I'm curious, and maybe you can't talk too much, you know, maybe it's proprietary information, but how do you manage the cooling? Obviously, you have the ocean all around you. Is there a heat transfer that takes place through the pod and the internal oil? And do you have to circulate the... I assume it's some kind of like mineral or whatever the fluid is inside. Do you have to circulate that to maintain the heat?
No. So essentially what happens is when the servers heat up, there's this sort of natural physical process that then takes place, which is the molecules heat up and they start to drift upwards and outwards. Mm-hmm. And it creates this turbulent flow within. And that flow... results in essentially a heat transfer between the inner wall, well, the inside of the pod and the outside of the pod in the water. So much like a pipeline, every pipeline has this also. There is the heat of the oil There's the inside of the pipe, there's the outside of the pipe, and then there's the water. So the heat of the oil goes to the inside of the pipe, which then takes it to the outside of the pipe, which then takes it to the water. The thing about the difference between pipelines and us is that the pipelines try and keep the heat in. So they actually close off their pipes. They like wrap them. Again, it's called the pip. And because they need the heat so that the oil doesn't like congeal. We're like, we hate heat, get out. So we have very thin walls, and it's very efficient because, and not to get like super nerdy and technical, but heat has fluid has a heat carrying capacity about 3,500 times more than air. So we just don't face any problems. We don't have to drain. We just rely on this natural passive free cooling.
That's actually pretty interesting. So just the convection from the heat making the oil inside move around, and you don't have to do any special active like pumping to just through the walls of the pod is enough to keep it cool enough. That's kind of brilliant in its simplicity. So
what's interesting about it is that there are two ways to put something into water. You can compensate from the inside, which we do, or you can make the walls very, very thick to withstand that pressure. But you can only really make the walls so thick before the space server coefficient is just like null. So what Microsoft did this before, they have a project, it's called Project Natick. And they built on the principles of a submarine. So they have their servers inside this chamber and they push in nitrogen and that keeps it cool. And nitrogen's like a really good choice because, again, it's less corrosive than the alternative. But what they do is sort of where you started off is they put seawater and they pump it around that inner chamber. So this double hull enclosure, they pump it around and the seawater then, you know, is essentially transferred into the other seawater and it takes away. And again, there as well, the thermal footprint is insignificant because the seawater is a stable temperature after the first layer. And it's extremely efficient.
So I was curious about if that's what if you had to do any sort of pumping like that, or if just touching the surrounding ocean was enough. So cool. Yeah. All right. Yeah. Doc had a question and I've been dominating. So go ahead, Doc.
Well, I'm trying to imagine what this, I'm sort of picturing this as it's powered, right? So power is coming from land somewhere, right? So how far offshore, I mean, you're running electricity out. Miles, thousand of miles. That's one question. The other is, are you in the middle of, like I'm thinking, okay, how do you splice fiber into this thing under the water? I know they do fix underwater things, but they generally bring it to the surface and then reconnect them, right? And then bring it back down again. So how does that get? Yeah. So I'm trying to imagine the connectivity of this thing, both in terms of the power to it and the cabling going in and out.
So fixing something underwater is slightly more difficult than what we do, because you're right, sometimes that will have to be brought up, especially if it's a cable. But what we do is make use of already established infrastructure. So an oil rig is already connected to power, right? We already have power going out to these places. So we splice those cables quite often, or we co-locate with them. And we also try to co-locate with renewable powers, which is much easier actually in the UK than it is here just now. And we also have like partners in Rolls-Royce who are putting out these small, they're not that small, but small modular reactors, like the size of a soccer field. And so we will be powered that way. But as of right now, what we do is just make use of that existing infrastructure. If we have to extend it, we will. And then what we do is everything's in the pod, the oil's in the pod, the fluid's in the pod, the servers are in the pod. It's been networked on land. It's disconnected for now. It's on the back of a vessel or it's about to be lowered into the sea. We push it down, we put it onto the seabed. And then, you know, people don't use them anymore because we typically use an AirPod, but you know, the jacks on the end of your headphones, if you ever use those, they look like those. They're just huge. They're just, a thousand times bigger. We take those with the ROV that we started off talking about that has those arms. We just take that and we plug it in to the existing space that we have into our pod. And just like that, it's now connected to power. It's you're essentially just plugging it in the way that you would in your home. And then we do the same for the cables. So what's interesting about subsea cables, again, the backbone of the internet, is that they have these, they're called branching units, BUs. So there are these essentially spaces within the cable where they can be extended, because sometimes humans can be forward thinking. So we build this in to say, okay, we will need more capacity on this line, or we will need to essentially push this cable to a different landing point on Earth soon, but not right now. So we'll build a place for that. And so what we do is say, hey, instead of pushing this cable to a second point on land, give us that space and connect us from there. And again, it's very much the same process. It's like a big sort of jack, and we plug it into our unit, and like that, we're connected to fiber and power.
So I find myself wondering, to what extent the future of your enterprise is tied in or tracks along with the growth of the marine world in general, yeah, as a matter of importance to us. There's a great site online. I just put it in our little back channel called marinetraffic.com. And yes, it shows, I mean, like most of the world is water, okay? And the amount of action going on out there is absolutely mind-boggling. It's huge, and it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger the more the world turns into one big place. I mean, an interesting thing about the internet, and this comes from my friend Craig Burton, who died last week, and his funeral is right now, as a matter of fact, and I'm not there, but he compared the world to a giant hollow sphere where we're all zero distance from each other. And that's how it looks right now. I mean, you're in Los Angeles, I'm in Indiana, Ant, our production is in Northern California. Sean's in Michigan, but we could be anywhere in the world. We're all zero distance apart right now, functionally zero distance.
Functionally,
but the world still works on this infrastructure. And infrastructure itself, I think, if people don't see it, it's not that well understood. And you know, I mean, our image of a data center is halls and halls and halls of blinking lights on walls, And you're busy rethinking how this works. Yeah. And it just strikes me that more and more of the world's future is going to be marine, whether we, like it or not. And you're sort of at the forefront for that. So I'm wondering how do you see progress going forward for you with this thing? How does your subsea thing grow?
I'll sort of start out by saying what I think is true for every founder. You tend to think that everybody must be thinking this and that you're too late, and often you're years too soon. And we have found that. I've found that people are not innovation ready, and it's sort of the old, well, we've always done it this way, so we'll continue to do it this way. And I'm sort of happy to fight against that for as long as it takes. And I think 70% of the world is water. And we have land shortages in every single sort of way. There's a really good book I really, really enjoyed. I read it recently. It's by Václav Smil. It's called How the World Really Works. And in that, he talks about land shortages. He talks about our reliance on fossil fuels and renewables, if they're scalable, if they're not, what can work and what can't. And one of the things that I took away from it is nothing, as humans, we tend to sit in one extreme camp most of the time. You're either all for it or not for it. But there's actually this sort of middle ground. So I don't think that all data centers will be undersea in 10 years. I would love that, but that's not going to happen. And I truly believe that going underwater is a net benefit to society, because we reduce carbon emissions by 40%. And, short of taking a huge lifestyle step back in the Western world, we're probably not going to reach the agreements that we've set out, the Paris Climate Accord Agreement. It's really unrealistic. But here we're saying for the largest consuming asset class on Earth, we can reduce the carbon that you're putting out by 40%, and by co-locating with like renewables and then where available, buy more. And people are like, no, because it's the ocean and it's scary, not understanding that the ocean is like the backbone of how society's been built. There's been no other thing that has, you know, light and oil are two of the things that have really helped us as humans be what we've become. And algorithms now are sort of that third co-evolutionary force. And they say, the algorithms say that, you know, it is actually very beneficial to put data centers underwater in between, you know, middle of the cables or towards the landing stations on either side. And so as that catches on and as more and more cables are deployed, I think that our future will continue to grow and the trend will go upwards. But it's a bit of a slog just now.
So, and I want to actually talk about that along with, because there's issues like with reduced latency and stuff that I kind of want to nerd out a little bit. But I know Doc has an ad to read. So in just a minute, let's talk more about latency and nerdy stuff.
Yes, perfect.
great tease there, Sean. Okay, so this episode of Frost Weekly, I'll take it again. This episode of Frost Weekly is brought to you by Bitwarden. Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, at work, or on the go, and is trusted by millions. With Bitwarden, you can securely store credentials across personal and business worlds. Every Bitwarden account begins with the creation of a personal vault. Bitwarden has big news. After launching the username generator last month, they're integrating with three popular email forwarding services that also happen to be open source: Simple Login, and an Addy and Firefox Relay. Now adding another layer of security and privacy is easier than ever. When using Bitwarden to generate a new username, the option to create an email alias is presented with a sub-selection for choosing your preferred service. Just enter the API key for your individual account with the chosen service, select the desired options, and once generated, a new alias is instantly registered to your account. Using unique usernames, email addresses, and passwords for every account is a powerful method for increasing internet security and privacy and adds protection to logins in the face of data breaches and leaks. This feature will be available on the Web Vault desktop app and browser extensions with mobile plan for a future release coming soon. Bitwarden is a must-need for your business. It's fully customizable and adapts to your business needs. Use Bitwarden Send, a fully encrypted method to transmit sensitive information, whether text or files. Generate unique and secure passwords for every site with enterprise-grade security that's GDPR, CCPA, HIPAA, and SOC 2 compliant. Their end-to-end encrypted vault helps mitigate phishing attacks. Their team's organization option is $3 a month per user. Share private data securely with coworkers across departments or the entire company. Enterprises can use Bitwarden's enterprise organization plan for just $5 a month per user. Individuals can use their basic free account forever for an unlimited number of passwords, or upgrade anytime to their premium account for less than $1 a month. Their family organization option gives up to 6 users premium features for only $3.33 a month. At Twit, we're big fans of password managers. Bitwarden is the only open source cross-platform password manager that can be used at home, on the go, or at work, and is trusted by millions of individuals, teams, and organizations worldwide. Get started with a free trial of a Teams or enterprise plan, or get started for free across all devices as an individual user at bitwarden.com/twit. That's bitwarden.com/twit. So Sean, you were saying asking.
Yeah. So during that ad, I actually thought too that it's interesting with the whole in oil or whatever the fluid is, there are some things that don't work. Like obviously spinning media storage doesn't work. And even if it was self-enclosed, the pressure would basically crush the hard drives, which would be cool to see, but just the one time. I'm sure that there's a lot of planning that goes in, like also obviously cooling, all that stripped out. I mean, I remember stripping out cooling fans, but pressure was not anything I ever had to consider when we were using submerged servers. But that was just a side thought I had during the ad. The other thing is, so the idea of the servers undersea, it seems ridiculous at first glance, right? When I saw this, I'm like, okay, servers underwater. But honestly, it makes a ton of sense for a lot of practical reasons. The carbon stuff, which you mentioned before the ad break, the idea that, you know, it can be powered by other things in the ocean is also a place where, you know, renewables are going to be more and more created. But all that aside, the latency. I mean, you are hooked into the backbone of the internet as it comes to near shore. And so that must be a very significant selling point. And I know I tend to ask like 27 questions, then give you the mic. But the other aspect of this is I can see that being an incredible boon for somebody who is buying, you know, the infrastructure space to put their servers. But I'm curious how this expands. And Doc was alluding to, you know, where do you go from here? How does this become something that an end user might someday use? And like, I'm not asking for your customer roles, but I mean, you know, maybe free advertisement for some, but are there companies who are considering these, I mean, edge of the backbone type places to then resell cloud services? I mean, in whatever form that might be, it just seems like not just regional data centers, but I mean, boom, the latency must be nothing.
27 questions. That's
like that's
1,000. Okay, I'm going to start out. I am going to get you back. So I'm going to start out with like the nerdiest sort of thing that I can see, which is, you know, if you have a company and you're not solving a problem, do you have a company? No, probably not. You shouldn't do it. And so we're not just pushing these underwater because it's cool, because it is cool, but like that's not enough. It's sort of the utility delta compared to the current status, like the current state of the art, times the number of people that you help. That's the calculation on which to base a company. And that's the calculation in which I based mine. And so latency is one of those like helping things. You don't see it. You don't notice if the data that you're trying to get served to you from a Google server someplace is a millisecond later, you probably won't notice that, but the financial markets do. The telemedicine markets, they do. So latency actually does become important. And there's a few ways to slice that, I suppose. So the first is that 55% of the world currently lives coastally, so more than half. And what we're seeing in traditional data centers is that they're moving further and further away from those metropolitan areas and into rural areas, and that introduces latency. The reason they are doing that is because it's cheaper, there are tax cuts, the power's typically cheaper, but it becomes a little bit worse for the environment in terms of the cooling that you need, because typically those are hot places or places where the amount of money that you have to put into it to get power there, to get telecoms there, is quite a lot. It's substantial. We don't face those problems. So by placing these data centers just for the end user off the coast, we can reduce that latency by up to about 98%. And that's, you know, significant. And then on top of that, we face a different problem in the cable industry. Light travels at the speed of light. I think it's like 189,000 miles per second, something like that. The light that goes within these fiber optic cables, that, you know, it's essentially on off for zero and one. they don't travel at the speed of light. They can't quite do that. If someone in the world can overcome that and speed that up, then we'll have, you know, even lower levels of latency. But until that happens, just placing them on the coast where most of the people live reduces that latency. I got you back there.
That's pretty good. No, that's
100
good.
Things. Yeah. Yeah. So, but did I answer everything? Yeah.
You answered probably like 13 of the seven. The other thing I'm curious about, though, is like where we go from here. And if there are companies who are going to take advantage of this, because at the end of the day, I want to play with a server that's, you know, on the bottom of the ocean. And I am not going to be able to afford to, you know, lease out one of your pods. And so are there companies that are, you know, filling them up with their server infrastructure and allowing people to take advantage of that? Because again, I see that as a huge thing.
They are. We're working with like multiple types of provider. And so you will do that. You will be able to do that one day. You personally sort of having your server as a person off there is a ways off. Because the industry is not looking at it like that just now, but just, you know, X company having their data on these servers is a thing of now. So depending on who you're sort of, where you're trying to get your information, you might already have data from one of our pods.
Very cool. But yes. Very cool. So are you just going to load one of your own pods up with servers and like sell virtual private servers to, you know, the whole world just to garner excitement over the possibilities? I don't know. This is why I don't own a business.
No, not yet. I think the only thing that I would do that I'm not doing just now is like more philanthropic sort of things. Like I would give to Bellingcat. I like what they do, but it's sort of difficult because you have to, I don't want to do what I think is personally like morally great, because there's always the other side who's like, here's the flaws, and the company doesn't have feelings as such, so I can't take sides. But yeah, I would like to. So I've talked us out of time, haven't I? We're at time, or are we not?
But Doc is very quiet. I think you're muted, Doc. Mm-hmm. Doc, are you muted? Doc? Because I'm sure what you were saying was amazing.
It looked
and I'm
great.
On camera
it looked
moving
great.
My mouth
it
and not actually saying anything, which is nothing new. we actually are less out of time than we usually say when we're close to being out of time. It's the first time a guest has said it before we have. what I could go to, though, is that, and this is not a bad way to wind it down. Is there anything we haven't asked yet that we should have asked that's on your list?
No,
and
wasn't on
Sean's 27 things that,
please don't let Sean ask me anything else.
We didn't count.
No, I mean, I think we covered it all. I tried not to like nerd out too much, but
that's not possible.
No, we're all about nerding out here.
Okay, good.
This is nerd land we're in right now.
I adopt me. Give me a passport.
Yeah, there's a...
I can tell we're winding down because my air conditioner has been off now long enough that my cheeks are
there it is.
Red.
Yeah, here's our back channel. See what you get to see what our IRC looks like.
How many octopuses are on your payroll? That's a great question.
Octopi. Yeah, and is it? They often give us good titles for shows as well.
I just want to say, octopuses and octopi are both proper plurals. Just want to say,
are
I
they?
Wasn't being foolish there.
Are
yeah,
you
yeah.
Sure?
Octopuses is also a proper plural. Oh yeah,
yeah. Uncertain. Actually, a couple
Google
nights
it.
Ago,
look
while,
this up.
Yeah, a couple nights ago, while I may or may not have been picking up COVID from friends who were there at this thing, we were talking about that great octopus movie, My Octopus Teacher, while we were in fact eating octopus. So it's there's the irony there. You know, we're carnivores or pescivores or whatever those are.
Pescatarian?
Yeah, I'm looking. I'm wondering is, I mean, when you pull these things up from down there, because obviously you retrieve them from time to time.
Yeah.
What weird things do you find on them? I'm just wondering.
Octopuses.
Has coral formed around them or what?
Yeah. So you know, I don't want to be like a, what's the word, a Pollyanna, maybe, and say that, oh, it's brilliant and all the fish love it. I'm not sure they do, or if I don't know if they do or if they don't. I just, you know, they're not harmful. But some fish acts as kind of like this, like artificial reef almost. Like things come and they sit on us and they, you know, they're just there and you can't peel them off. And so we just try and get them back in. But yeah, things come and hide beside our pods from predators. And we have cameras on the outside also, again, for like that human bias, but we get to see a lot. And when we go down with the subs, with the ROVs, we also get to see like what's there, what's lurking. Is there going to be a fish fight? But everything sticks to us. Everything. So.
Wow. So now we actually are at the end of the almost end. So let me ask the two final questions. One is, what's your favorite text editor and scripting language?
Oh God.
Ask everybody.
My favorite editor is probably Vi, although it's been years. And language is, I don't want to talk about why, but it's because it's easy, is Python.
Those are probably our two most popular answers.
Our two most popular answers. See, you fit right into the nerdery.
You fit right in with the. We close by nerding out. So this is awesome. This has been a very fun show, and as always, when they're extremely fun, has gone way too fast. We'll have to have you back. We tell almost everybody that. And I'm hoping guests that we didn't ask that are not feeling offended.
Awesome.
But anyway, this has been terrific. So thanks again. We wish you extreme luck and buoyancy or whatever would be the right.
If I'm correct.
Non-buoyancy.
Yes. If I'm correct, I think octopuses should be part of the title of the show.
High specific gravities.
They should be part of the title of the show. I agree. And also, no, thank you for having me. It did go really fast, and I hope it was interesting for most people. And thank you.
I mean, it was for me. Everybody else.
Okay, good. That's whatever. There are other people.
Sean's our proxy. He's our proxy. If he gets it, it's all good. So thanks again.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
So Sean, dude, that was awesome.
It was. And, you know, it's funny. We talked in the pre-show. We wanted to make sure to talk about the open source intelligence part because, I mean, that it's kind of the foundation of so many aspects of it. But I really wanted to talk about undersea data centers so bad. And then it just got cooler and cooler. I mean, filled with oil. And I had actually worked with servers that were submerged before. Yeah, it was just super cool.
I go back far enough so that I just remember AM station transmitters that were water cooled. That's yeah. Actually, last week I visited the biggest one in the U.S. It was 500,000 watts in the 30s, and they had a giant.
And those are scary too. Those AM towers. I mean, they'll kill you dead really quick.
Yeah. This is a diamond shaped one, WLW in Cincinnati. But there, and it was like for like several years in the 30s, it was 500,000 watts. The maximum for all the rest of them is 50,000, so 1/10 that power. And you know, and it was massive signal. Anyway, the an interesting thing to me about open source is that it started as a military term, and it started as, you know, open source intelligence came along before open source became a geek thing in 1998. A bunch of geeks decided they were going to adopt that term in 1998. It had already been tried by the military and was well understood for a long time before that, but the geeks made it take off. So a little bit of history there. So what's your plug, man?
Still doing the cartoon? Yeah, I know we're running out of time. Yeah, no. So right now I'm just starting on my YouTube channel, a Linux Plus series, like the full. So Linux Plus just did a revision on their exam. So if you want to get Linux Plus certified, if you go, to my YouTube channel and you can check it out. One of the playlists is, maybe I didn't put it on my page there, but it's just, snar.co/Linux Plus, all spelled out. And we just started. I think there's like three videos in the series, that first one right there with me in the blue shirt. And we're going to go through the entire list of objectives and learn Linux together. And it just started. So I'm looking forward to it.
Fantastic. That's great. Sean is great, people. He does good videos. He does all good stuff. And so I'll plug you too. And this is where I plug who's coming on next week, but we are moving the schedule around. So it will be somebody great. It's just not somebody we know at this moment. So I will see you in a week. And so take care. See you soon.
Hey, what's going on, everybody? I am Ant Pruitt, and I am the host of Hands On Photography here on Twit TV. I know you got yourself a fancy smartphone, you got yourself a fancy camera, but your pictures are still lacking. Can't quite figure out what the heck shutter speed means? Watch my show. I got you covered. Want to know more about just the ISO and exposure triangle in general? Yeah, I got you covered. Or if you got all of that down, you want to get into lighting, you know, making things look better by changing the lights around you. I got you covered on that too. So check us out each and every Thursday here on the network. Go to twit.tv/hop and subscribe today.